The Positive Mind with Armand DeMille.
Hi, everybody. This is Armand DeMille with you with The Positive Mind here on WBAI 99.5 FM on your dial. Bringing you ideas, concepts, and guests to help you lead a more positively minded life. And today we're going to talk about an aspect of relationships that's just another way of looking at things. We're going to look at two important aspects. We have some guests sitting in with us from Germany here in the studio, which will be on air with us a little later. But right now I want to talk about the love delusion. Delusion. I like that, the love solution. Mating intelligence. How's that for a new phrase? We had emotional intelligence a couple of years ago. And everybody took to that very nicely. Because what is emotional intelligence? It's how tuned in are you with your emotions? How do you know them? How do you understand with them? How do you deal with them? Mating intelligence is the new buzz phrase among scientists who are trying to understand how we conduct our love lives. It makes sense if you consider that beyond the prose and the music lies a psychological minefield of relationships. Anyone who has been in love knows that romantic relationships are full of spin, illusions, delusions, misleading half-truths, some barefaced lies. Yes, my friends, it's a game of manipulation and the stakes are high because each date that you have at the beginning is a crucial interview, the ultimate prize, nothing less than the chance to form a fruitful, lifelong partnership. So no wonder we need our wits about us. So one of the things that people do at the beginning, as all animals in the animal world do, and may I certainly recommend the New Earth series on, that thing I've been watching. It's just amazing. They show birds and how birds do their love lives and how they attract by building nests or splaying their feathers. We humans do a similar thing. How come love feels so decidedly irrational? Over the past decade, the psychologists have increasingly realized just how much of our mental life goes on under the radar of consciousness. And mating behavior is no exception. And that simply means that there are so many things we think we know we're doing, and there is so much more that we don't know. Someone once described it as being like an iceberg. You know, you see the tip of the iceberg, but what's under the water is so much more, and that's our unconscious. What they're finding is that both paradoxical and shocking. It seems that when it comes to love, men and women are designed to lie. That's how they're designed. They're designed to misconstrue, misread, misunderstand, and deceive one another and themselves. Now, you're going to sit there and you're going to say, no, not me. I only want a relationship based on truth. Well, you look more closely at the unconscious working of the mating mind, and you'll discover that, in fact, they make good sense. It makes good sense. You may not consider it a deception that you decide to put on makeup when you go on your first date, but after you've been married 10 years, you may not put on the makeup. What does that mean? You know? You put on that eyeshadow at the first couple of dates, but you may not put on that eyeshadow. And what about the women? Okay. Anyway. Look more closely at the unconscious working of the mating mind. You become a deluded romantic is often the best way to make a good biologically successful choice about a potential partner. If you could delude yourself, you get a better chance of choosing a partner. That's what they found. Even before the first date, unconscious biases affect the way we play the mating game. Who we choose, the kind of person we choose, the kind of person that attracts us. So they did a bunch of interviews, and it turns out that there are many mistakes that men and women make in the perception of each other. Men tend to overestimate the sexual interest conveyed by a woman's smile or laughter. A man often thinks that just because she's laughing with me, she wants to go to bed with me, or she's willing to go to bed with me, or just because she's smiling at me, it means she's sexually attracted. When men see someone of the opposite sex smile at them, they tend to think she is interested. Women simply see a smile, and that's not all. It turns out that the smarter a man is, the more likely he is to perceive, to make this misperception, that a smile means a sexual interest. So the more intelligent, the more educated, the higher up the intelligence scale he goes, the more deluded a man could be about interpreting a smile. Men, Glenn Gaya from the State University of New York at Newport asked men how they thought women would respond to an advertisement in which the men offered no strings attached sex. So if a man just put out an ad and he said, okay, here's what I've got, no strings attached sex. The higher the IQ of the man, the more he believed the ad would work. The lower the IQ, the less he believed it would work. Meaning that intelligence gives the perception that women are much more interested in sex than they believe. Men's overstimulation of women's interest is matched by another bias among women who think that men are keener on casual sex than they actually are. In another study, Hazelton asked groups of men and women for their views on how much various types of mating behavior, such as a man buying jewelry for a woman, signaled potential long-term interest. Women were generally more skeptical about men. Women, it seems, are inclined to see men as manipulative and that they all want just casual sex, which is not the case. So here we have two very interesting perceptions. Why? Why would we believe these things? You know, clearly these biases could lead to mistakes. Nevertheless, you know, it seemed that the more we went on to prove it, the better it was. The errors in judgment came in two broad types. False positives. A false positive is when you think something is not there. That is there is not there. That's a false positive. And false negatives, when we fail to see something that is there. Get that distinction? A false positive, you think something is, there is something there, but you don't see it. A false negative, no, I'm sorry, the false positive is you see something that is not there. It's a false positive. You make it there. False negative is you don't see what is there. So they went along a little, and a man's she wants me bias, a man who believes this, may lead to an embarrassing moment if it turns out that a woman is not as keen as he thought. So, you know, this is the kind of thing that you see very often where the man finally gets the woman to go out with him for dinner, and then he is sure that if he professes his love or his intention, she's going to be interested. And this is the one where the woman looks at him and says, oh, no, you're a nice guy, but I'm not interested in that. Well, that turns out to happen a great deal more. So there must be a reason for this. And what we're trying to figure out is why would we have built this into our Darwinian survival method? Women's belief that men are manipulative, that they are definitely invested in being careful with a man. A woman believes she must be careful with a man. Now, we're not saying that any of this is true or not true, but they are very concerned with men and their truth and what's not true. Some women tend to choose a man in different circumstances. He showed some women a selection of personal ads written by men and asked them to choose the most appealing one. Now, if a woman were looking for just casual sex, she was asked to choose from a number of ads, including photographs of somebody. Do you think they would have chosen the more attractive, well-built, handsomer type? Even for casual sex, no. She would pick somebody who would have the same characteristics that she would be looking for in a long-term relationship. So it is not the handsome stud that gets all the women. It is generally that he is a good provider and that he is wealthy, generous, and kind are the single most appealing things sexually to a woman. Wealthy, generous, and kind. Wealthy, and I don't mean wealthy just with money. Wealthy meaning I can provide. You know, I can take care of you. That seemed to be more of a turn-on than just I'm here and I'm sexually potent. That's not the only difference between men and women in the sexual arena, but they found a great deal of difference in this idea about lying. So what do women lie about and what do men lie about? Most people, men and women, say that men are more likely to lie about the following things. They'll tell a lie to avoid making their partner angry. Very big deal. They say they're in love when they're not, especially when asked. Do you love me? What's the answer? Of course. The fact that they're asking, do you love me, means that he didn't say it in the first place. If you say it right before a crucial moment in sex, guaranteed 99% affirmation. They lie about things. People believe this now. This is not that men really do it. It's what they believe about men. They lie about things in their past that their partner would not approve of. So if a man has a shady past, he may not tell the story, especially in this day of AIDS, where people are more concerned about your sexual history. Men will tend to lie about their histories. The biggest, most common deception that men seem to make is how much money they have or how much money they make. And in the dating game, this is very important. Because it's not the money in the bank, it's how good a provider are you. So men try to show themselves as being a little more flush than they are. Men also tend to lie about future plans, such as marriage. They will lie that they are looking for, you know, they're really searching for a future relationship. And men tend to lie about the time they spend with their friends. Now, this is a very interesting thing. Most men think or believe, and it's probably true, it's a turn-on to tell someone that they spend a lot of time with friends of the same sex. I think it's because they want to not have you believe that they're spending time with other women. So they say they spend a lot of time with their friends, and women who believe that men spend more time with their friends are more comfortable and more likely to be safe. And men tend to lie about having a sexually transmitted disease. They do. They do. They will not say, I've got herpes. They will not say it. If it's not active, they tend not to say it. They will not say about most of the stuff that they have. So now this is not only true, both men and women believe this is true about men and what they lie about. Now, what women tend to lie about, that's an interesting question, don't you think? They lie about flirting or being interested in other people. You know, a guy comes along and says, I saw you looking at him. No, I have no interest in him whatsoever. So even though men may do that a lot, women actively lie about it. They lie about birth control. This is a common thing nowadays. It's gotten to a point, I was speaking to someone the other day who said, no man will have sex with a woman any longer without contraception. I said, why? I said, wouldn't he prefer to? And they said, no, it's not that. It's like there seems to be this thing about entrapment into fatherhood. With genetics there, it's no longer a question if a woman can entrap a man. So men are afraid of getting trapped. So women, they believe, will lie about birth control. Women also lie, they exaggerate how attractive or intelligent they think the man they are with is. Now, this comes down to another case where they lie about this. When a woman or a man falls in love, something tends to take place. You tend not to see the rough spots, and you tend to, through this, well, here's the way they say it happens, because we're really curious about why do we fall in love? What is this falling in love experience? When you fall in love, something chemically happens to your body, and there is this thing that if you convince yourself that you have this in-love experience, you get this dopamine, right? And that's why they call you a dope. Because when dopamine is going through your body, you get relaxed, you get comfortable, you feel turned on, everything is nice. With the dopamine surge, with this comfort that's going on in your body, you also tend to look with glazed eyes at your partner, and you see good things. They look better than they are. So falling in love helps you love the one you're with. See more. Now, why would we have that? Nature, it seems, has designed that there are too many partners out there, and it's very confusing, and we need people to stop long enough and be with each other so that they could hook up and maybe have babies. So what nature decided is they gave the humans this falling in love thing, because only humans have it. And the falling in love thing that humans have is what happens to them is they get gaga for one reason or another, and then they don't see the other person's attributes, the negatives, and they see the positives and they glorify the positives. So now women in particular will glorify their mates to other people. So they'll say, look, oh, he's wonderful. He's the best lover in the world. He's the most, he's giving. And they just tell all the good news to their friends at the beginning of a relationship. They also tend to glorify their partners when they are interested in having a baby, because they could use this rationale of feeling like they only see the good news when they see their partner is all positive and not negative. It is harder, it seems, to conceive a child when you are not totally there, and the dopamine helps you have babies. Interesting little bit of chemistry, don't you think? So, women also lie about one other thing. They lie about how impressed they are by their partner's sexual anatomy or performance. They tend to lie to their partners about how they like their genitals. Oh, it's the best one I ever saw in my life. And they tend to lie about, how was that? Oh, it was great. You know, great. Did you come? Oh, 18 times. You know, it was fantastic. And then there's one other lie that women have. Women lie about their sexual histories. For some reason, they have learned that telling a man about what you've done in the past does not pay. Because he'll focus on it, he'll compare himself to it, and it's not what he wants to hear. Isn't that interesting? This is Armand DeMille. We're talking about the love delusion, talking about mating intelligence in the average world out there. Not you guys, not the WBAI folk. We know you all tell the truth. We know you meet somebody and you don't do this, but it's what goes on in the world, and you should know it, because we're going to teach you this part, and then later we're going to teach you about other things like how people make contact. What people say men and women are equally likely to do. Both men and women lie about. What do you think is the one thing that men and women lie about? Try to guess. It is the past, kind of, says John, who's assisting me today. Men and women lie about their virginity. Men don't have a virginity. They can't say that they are virgins. And women tend to say that they are. So virginity tends to be a thing that men and women both lie about. Men and women both tell a lie to spare their romantic partner's feelings. Now, when you love somebody and that somebody says, do you like his buttocks better than mine? Right? Oh, no, you have the nicest. You know what I mean? You tend to lie to spare the other's romantic feelings. Now, we learned that men tend to lie to avoid making their partner angry, which kind of goes into this. In fact, we will learn that men's greatest lie is to control the emotions of the tendency to become emotional woman. You understand? Since women tend to have more emotions available, The man wants to control them, and so he becomes the train conductor. So if I lie to you and I'm not gonna let you get angry, I control your anger. I'm not gonna let you get too sad, I'm gonna tell you good news. I'm not gonna let you feel despair, I'm gonna boost you up. So men control women's emotions. And they'll do anything to have that happen. And women, it turns out, tend to be attracted to the men who are the most efficient at doing it. The guy who controls my emotions the best. The man who stops me from getting angry. The man who makes me feel good when I feel bad. The guy who makes me laugh when I'm depressed. So in other words, the women tend to appreciate the man who can do the most manipulation, controlling your emotions and doing whatever they have to do that. And the other lie that both people, and everybody agrees both people do, is they lie about how impressed they are by their partner's body or figure. Men and women tend to tell each other that they look great, you know? If they're staying together, they don't want to deal with the consequences of not saying they look great. This is Armand DeMille with you with The Positive Mind. And we're talking about trying to find out what these things are that people do. Women were thought to be more likely to lie about things like the use of birth control, their virginity, and how impressed they were with their partner's sexual performance. Men were seen as more likely to lie about future commitment, whether they are really in love, and how much money they make. Now, whether you are really in love is a question. Are you really in love means, are you having a dopamine surge, and is your eyes going glassy when you look at me like mine are? You know, well, men tend not to have that happen as much. But there seems to be a pressure to get a consensus. So the pressure to have a consensus about glassy-eyed, dopaminic feelings is to have a person respond to the affirmative, oh, yes, darling. Yes, I feel the same way as you do. How could I not? With the same glassy-eyed look that imitates the I'm in love look. Because a man doesn't know when he's in love, except every now and then he figures this must be in love because that's the only person I want to spend my time with. Therefore, I must be in love. But it's not with this giant surge of feeling that a woman has far more capacity to feel. Falling in love involves a delusion that a given person is the ideal partner for you. Now, this is the thing. Love is a gross exaggeration of the difference between one person and everybody else. Get this survey that was fascinating. So they went around and they asked 6,423 people. Nah, they asked 27 people. They asked a few people. Something like when they met a few hundred, 128 people. They asked 128 people who are in love. Rate your partner now on a scale of 1 to 10. How do you think they rated their partner? 10, right? My partner now, I'm in love. He's a 10. She's a 10. She's fantastic. Rate your last partner on a scale of 1 to 10, oh, they almost inevitably said a 7, and rate the one before that, and the numbers went down with each one in the past. So that means that each time you were in love, you moved a person up from a 3 to a 10, but they were bound for 3-ness eventually. Now, what does that mean? Does it mean that you're not in love? Does it mean you don't feel that love? Does it mean that it changes? It means that when you look backwards, you don't have that chemical affecting you in the same way. So when the dopamine's not there, looking backwards, you say, oh, it's only a 5. But when the dopamine's there and the other hormones are there in the present, I feel a 10. So looking, the problem with this is everybody who's in love thinks they found their soulmate. And this is a problem. It means that all the other ones were soulmates too, all the other times. So what does it become? An ex-soulmate? Or a, you know, I used to be somebody's soulmate and I'm no longer their soulmate, so I'm available for a new soulmate? So it becomes very difficult to believe each time. But of the 300 people we studied, all happened to be with the ideal mate, while all 300 prior partners were duds. By comparison, They rarely met anyone who said, yes, I'm madly in love, but I was more in love with the last person. Because you just don't experience it this way. You know, Chaucer said, love is blind. Now, lovers may be deluded, but again, this love blindness, it's not a design defect, you know? It pays. We tend to eulogize the qualities of our loved one, especially at crunch times. When we get under a lot of pressure, we tend to find our partner is even bigger than they are and better than they are. And at times, like I said, about having children. So what does that mean? What does it mean? Does it mean that it's all illusion? Does it mean that this whole game of falling in love has nothing to it? No, it's part of the grand design. It's the way it's meant to work. It's like pheromones, you know? It's like we give you a thing that you could smell in your other partner, and you smell it, and it makes you feel attracted to them. And the pheromones carry some genetic DNA encoding that carry messages about what you need for your future babies, right? It says to you, in the very smell of your partner, you could tell that there is something in their immune system that you need in your immune system, and that's why you're attracted. That's how amazing it is. And to you, it's nothing. If I say to you, do you love the smell of your mate? In another survey that they did with a couple of hundred people talking about the smell of their mate, of course, 100% said, I love the smell of my mate. But then when they talked about their past mate, nothing. But you understand that nothing used to be the best smeller on earth. It's just remarkable. How are we ever going to get past this, guys? How do we ever get to the point where you can master this game? Well, you don't. You just give in as much as you can. You hope to live as few illusions as you can. As my dear friend Christine Ulrich brought to my attention, she said she spoke to someone who said, my life is full of drama, most of which have never happened. I think that's a beautiful quote. I'm going to put that on the mirror. My life is full of drama, most of which have never happened. And romance feels like drama. Romance, this person you're with, you know. I asked a young woman today, earlier today, do you have someone you're, well, I have someone I'm seeing, she said. But I don't, she could tell she didn't feel that click. There was no dopamine present. It wasn't there yet. Right? If he responds a certain way, maybe it'll be present. If he tells the right lies, maybe it'll be present. If she tells the right lies, maybe he'll act in a way as if it's present, so she'll act in a way as if it's present. You know what I mean? Maybe he'll have the glassy eyes, and then she'll have the glassy eyes in response, because glassy-eyed people tend to have glassy eyes in response to other people's glassy eyes. That's the idea, you know, of glassy eyes. This is Armand DeMille with you with A Positive Mind. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we're going to talk to our guest, Iris Reiner, from a psychologist from Germany, who's going to talk to us about attachment theory, which is very interesting, because this is why and how and if you could possibly form a long-term relationship. We'll be back with you in a couple of minutes. That's right. That is realistic. R-I-O-L-I-S-T-I-C. Realistic. Bossa number 5. You can wiggle, but don't smile. And this is Armand DeMille with you with The Positive Mind here on WBAI 99.5 FM on your dial. Bringing you ideas, concepts, guests, and some decent music to help you lead a more positively minded life. And we were talking about romance, the illusions of romance, some of the lies of romance, some of the reasons. I mean, you know, don't get mad at people because they lie. It's the design of things. You know, I found out that he really does not, he's only a messenger on his job. But that's his job. His job is to get you to see past all of the things you don't want to see, you know, and to finally get to a point where you accept him, and then maybe he'll make himself so valuable to you. It's not just to have sex that they lie. It's like they are trying to bond. They are trying to do it. You know, if you ever looked at a gorilla tribe or if you looked at a couple of antelopes trying to get their way, it's the second-class citizens that have the hardest time attracting mates. You know, the alpha male, that's easy. He's got it made because, you know, all he has to do is kill or be killed. You know, somebody's going to eventually kill him and knock him off, and that's the end of his reign. But until then, he doesn't have much challenge. He's got his time to develop himself, keep physically fit, because he's got his spot. But it's the secondary males and the secondary females that have to work so hard at trying to find a partner. And so we are always working, or you are usually working, to try to find somebody who is going to love you, cherish you, and take care of you. But you're hampered by a few other things. Not just are you hampered by lies and deceptions and frauds and, you know, who wants sex and who doesn't and do you think I'm sexually adequate kind of stuff. How about this? So I bring with me today in the studio Dr. Christina Ulrich, who is with us today, and Iris Reiner, both from Germany. Christina Ulrich's been working with me as my research assistant for a while, but she's leaving the country soon. Christina, welcome back to the radio station. There you are.
Hi, Armand.
Hi there, Christine. Back. Yeah, good. Thank you so much for your help with the research, always. And I want people to know that it's always Christina somewhere behind the research all the time. Iris, here you are.
Hi.
Oops. Now try again.
Hi, Armand. Hi. Nice to be here.
Isn't this exciting?
Yeah, it is.
Exciting because an hour ago we had a meeting, we had a staff meeting, and Christina brought Iris by, and Iris told us what she was interested in, and I said, boy, that goes along with the radio program I'm doing today. Come on the radio. But this is new for you, right?
Yeah, it is.
First time?
Second time.
Second time ever on the radio?
Yes.
Oh, that's, you did a Playboy interview?
No, that wasn't on the radio.
Well, what was that about, the Playboy interview? That's an interesting thing. You're a writer.
No. I was working as a freelance journalist during my studies, or I'm still am. And it was an interview with a German Playboy editor, and it was about his work and what Playboy all is about, and that, you know, he's got a. Right now, there are many other magazines like Playboy, and Playboy used to be like, wow, the only naked woman magazine, or like high-class naked woman magazine. And now there's FHM and there are like so many others. So he told what Playboy really is, like what makes it unique.
Well, and how did you like doing that interview?
It was interesting. It was quite interesting, yeah.
He wasn't all about sex. He wasn't all.
No, not at all. He was very professional.
He's a business person.
He's a business person and a journalist.
And the business of sex is an interesting thing, and the business of attractiveness and the business of attachment, you know?
Yeah.
When you think about Playboy magazine and what that was and how that exploited women for a long period of time, and then what they added to it. So let's talk about your area of specialization. Psychology is what you care about.
Yes.
And what's your area of study? Well, many, but attachment theory.
Attachment theory, yeah. I'm studying the relationship between attachment at a personality and specific genetic markers in adulthood.
How's that for a mouthful? You have to learn. This is very important. This is going to be your thesis, right?
Yeah.
What's the name of your thesis going to be? What are you going to call it?
Attachment, personality, and genetic markers in adulthood.
Attachment, personality, and genetic markers.
And genetic markers in adulthood, yeah.
But that is not going to be the name.
No?
Because you're going to do it in German.
I'm writing it in English.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
I take it back. Well, attachment theory and genetic markers. We'll get to the genetic markers in a little bit, but attachment theory. Attachment theory is fascinating because it says we all have a connectivity or an ability to connect based on a few things that we could judge. Okay, Christine, whenever you feel like being in the middle of this, jump right in. Describe to me attachment theory as best you can.
Okay.
And whenever you need a translation, go over to Christine.
All right. Okay, so attachment theory basically traces back to John Bowlby. He's like the father of attachment theory, and he developed it on basically he was a child psychiatrist, and he developed it in his research with children. So he was like doing studies on how children react when they get separated from their parents, and he actually like developed this attachment theory, and he said like the attachment system or attachment is an innate urge like hunger or sex. So it's not like it's a primary motivation drive or primary drive. So children have like this innate urge to attach to their parent, and biologically that makes sense. Like that.
Sure, it makes sense. Otherwise, how else would you get through? You
yes.
Know? If you're a penguin and you've got to go running to your mother.
Mm-hmm.
Do you ever see penguins? You know, the penguin egg, after it hatches, how they could recognize the mother, they go, oh, this is just amazing. So, attachment has always been through all of the evolution of every animal.
Always.
Attachment's been important, but now attachment theory. This is about how we attach.
Yes, it's about how we attach and that we do develop different attachment styles.
Good.
Depending on how, first of all, like how our temperament or dispositional differences are, or what experiences we make. And well, this attachment is a concept that not only has been developed for children, it's like a concept from cradle to grave. So we still have our attachment style systems or representations in us, also we are not really like not like attached as a child is.
So what we're saying is, from cradle to grave, we have this kind of basis of our attachment. The way we attached as children, most likely, is going to be the way we attach later. Is that right, Iris?
Well, attachment can change. So it's not that, you know, like that's fixed. So your attachment style or your attachment representation is going to be fixed like in the first year or interaction with a mother. It can change, and you do have relationships with other people, and with you do have romantic relationships, and of course your attachment style can change, but still you have a certain attachment style.
So that we'll say there's a fundamental attachment style that most likely continues, especially on the unconscious, if you are not somebody who has kind of looked at it a little bit.
Yeah, and what I found interesting is that, especially in intimate relationships, you show up the same kind of behavior you showed in terms of attachment that you showed with your primary caregiver, which is most of the times the mother.
So most people relate to their mates in some way the same way they related to their mother. Now this is very interesting information, because you're going to think about women who are going to say, no, it had to be the way I related to my father. No, this is what we've learned over here. What we've found is that most women who get related to men, at first they love the masculinity of the man, but the parts that they object to and the parts they have the trouble with is the men eventually turn into mothers. Men of women generally don't keep on this father identification. They become the ones who begin to nag. They become the ones who begin to be the caretakers. and there it tends to be much more in a mother role. So we're going to take a look at this. Let's look at the original attachment and the basic personality styles of attachment. Now, when a person has a relationship with their mother, it could be either there, it's a good one or a bad one, right?
Yes. You say it's either a you're either securely attached or insecurely attached.
Okay, so we have now a new jargon, a new vocabulary that is being used by the scientists of the world who are studying this, and they call it either securely attached or non-securely attached. What is secure attachment?
Secure attachment in, are we talking about adulthood?
Call it in childhood, because we'll see it as an adulthood as well.
Secure attached children would actually, when the mother leaves, they would feel sad. They would feel upset, but knowing that the mother will return back, they will calm down when the mother returns, and they always prefer the mothers to strangers.
And so they'll feel slightly upset, but they won't get.
Yes, they do feel upset, but they are able to regulate their emotions. They're being upset. They're able to calm down.
So that's secure attachment.
That's secure attachment.
Okay, and in adulthood, how would secure attachment manifest?
Secure also in the ability to regulate emotions effectively. And in, of course, in adulthood, you don't see adults being upset when the mother goes out of the room and crying like an infant would do. But you assess.
Wait. Who doesn't see that?
Okay.
I mean, many adults do that.
Oh.
Many adults, when they see their mate go away for a little bit, they get very, very upset. And you're saying that's an insecure attachment, that the person feels more shaken than they might normally be by the absence of their mate. And you're saying, that's not secure. Secure would be they get slightly shaken. Of course, nobody wants to lose their partner for a little while, but then they get over it.
Because they know the partner will return.
Well, even if the partner dies.
Yeah.
Even if the partner dies, they'll get over it.
Yeah, because they are able to deal with negative emotions and with separation.
Right, and that's a very big thing. My guest is Iris Reiner and Dr. Christine Ulrich. We're talking about separation theory, and this is very important. So it's very clear, and it's a very complex thing you're presenting here.
Mm-hmm.
A secure attachment is the nature of an attachment as a child and as an adult that has a sense of security to it.
Mm-hmm.
About the other person's leaving. Now, of course, there's the other side of it. There's, what do they call it, the insecure or the non-secure?
Insecure.
Insecure. Okay, how does insecure relationship manifest? Or insecure attachment manifest?
Insecure attachment style in infancy, basically, there are two different ways of being insecure attached, like as an infant, like either avoiding the mother or avoiding negative feelings during the separation, or like being ambivalent about them or being preoccupied about them as an adult later.
You describe two.
Two different ones.
One is the Teflon kind of nothing touches me, I don't care.
Yes.
I'm beyond it. Now, this is both right. In childhood and adulthood. How many grown-ups do you know, my friends, where you're in a relationship and, I don't know where she went. You know, she's off, it doesn't matter. And the feeling is one of dismissal, right?
Yes.
Is that the way it's described?
It.
You dismiss the attachment. You don't mm-hmm. show, you have a less than ordinary sense of attachment.
Dismissing of attachment, right.
Okay. And now, on the other hand, there's this other one. What's that called? The one where your person gets really nervous and upset and emotional.
In adulthood, it's described immersed or preoccupied.
Preoccupied.
Yeah.
And preoccupied attachment is where you can't stand it when your partner is not secure. You know, I'll bet jealousy plays an enormous role in preoccupation attachment. Don't you think?
Yes.
I mean, why are you, what does jealousy have to do with it as much as my partner went away and somebody else is going to take them?
Yeah.
So tell me more signs of the preoccupied attachment.
So preoccupied attached people, they would be not be able to regulate the negative emotions by like going too much into them, by like really being preoccupied by thoughts, by negative thoughts, by angry thoughts. And that, of course, manifests also in behavior such as like jealousy or
or deep upset, you know. Like I know a couple that gets together twice a week, and if suddenly it drops to once a week, you know, for 1 week, you know, and one of the people get very upset. They get, oh, I can't stand it. I'm not seeing you, you know, this day, and it's a very big upset. Mm-hmm. The times it gets very big upset shows that kind of attachment, that kind of insecure attachment, and the insecure attachment specifically of that type.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's one or two ways. You could either be dismissive of it and it's still insecure, or you could be overly attached and it's still insecure. And both are showing signs that this probably has a history somewhere early childhood, right?
Yes.
Is that true, Iris? Have they located, have they been able to correlate the early childhood with the adult behaviors?
So what we do know is that parents, actually securely attached parents, are more likely to have securely attached children. But in terms of the consistency from childhood to adulthood, the correspondence rate is rather low due to the fact that childhood attachment and childhood is measured in terms of behavior. And in adulthood, you do an interview. So, like, one is behavioral and the other one is verbal. So they are, like, two different systems of attachment. But, you know, like, it's still attachment.
Makes it difficult. Well, since we have just a few minutes, I want you to – and thank you for being here. And maybe, you know, when you come back to visit us or when we go to Germany and broadcast from Bavaria. You're in Bavaria?
Yeah, yeah.
Mm, lots of cream pies. When we go to Bavaria, we're going to ask you this question further, but I want to know about the DNA.
Okay.
What does this have to do with mitochondria?
So actually, for a long time, researchers thought attachment is a relational construct, but now the more research, or like due to new molecular genetic techniques, we do find individual differences, dispositional differences, both in children and in adulthood. But for example, we do know that children with a specific genotype are more likely to be more likely to show certain behavior in attachment-related situations. And I personally found in my study on the relationship between adulthood, adult attachment, and genetic markers that adults who carry the dopamine D4 receptor gene, so here we come again
the D4,
to dopamine.
DRD4
gene.
DRD4.
The 7-repeat allele.
My favorite gene.
Yeah, is it?
So, I don't know why somebody, you know, like who produces dungarees doesn't come out with a DRD4 gene. You know, it would be really a hip thing to do. What about the DRD4? That's your best gene you got.
So the 7-repeat allele, it's like a certain version of this, which has been linked. I found it to be linked to secure attachment in adulthood, more likely. But always important with genetic studies, it's not like a 100% match. So it's not deterministic.
It's like a predisposition.
Yes, it's probabilistic.
Is it the long one or the short one?
The long one.
The long one. Yeah. We're talking about, believe it or not, we're talking about alleles in genes in the DRD4, which means if you have the long gene, long genes, good name for something. If you have a long gene, it would mean that you're going to be more likely to have a secure attachment than if you have those short genes, which are like cutoffs there.
In adulthood.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Iris. I mean, I've gotten a lot from this. Christine Ulrich, what an experience for you, and to watch your student here present herself on radio. How was that for you?
Oh, wonderful. She did a great job, I think.
Yeah, and you've done a great job, and thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for letting me come. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, and I'll get you a copy of this. But you'll be able to listen to this. Now, listen to this. Now, when do you go back to Germany?
On Saturday.
On Saturday. By the time you get back to Germany,
you'll
be able to go to thepositivemind.com. Uh-huh. You'll go into the radio show.
Yeah.
You'll see archives.
Uh-huh.
And under the archives, you will press a button, and you can listen to this program.
Oh,
The very one we're doing right now. And you could mail it to all of your friends. So everybody can hear you on the radio all over the world.
Okay.
See? Great. Spread the wisdom. This is Armand DeMille. If you want a copy of today's program, if you could go to thepositivemind.com or go to the website of WBAI.org, my friends, where you should be able to get into the archives as well. I'll be back with you on Tuesday at 1 p.m. Special thanks to Michael G. Haskin for his flawless engineering, as usual. And I will be back with you on, when will I be back with you? On Tuesday, 1 p.m. Here we go. I think there's something happening there. Well, there's something not happening there. What is that going on? There it is. Thank you.